Atlantic time zone. I live on an island in the middle of the Caribbean Sea. It is definitely the Shabbat of this evening. We celebrate the Shabbat with Yah as a time to cherish our relationship with our God rather than a time to do nothing. It's a very different attitude that is taken by the rabbis who have made this the most torturous day of the week and a week that they have established thousands of laws regarding what one cannot do. This evening on our program, we're going to do a number of things. Last week, I presented a timeline so that we might better appreciate the role the red heifer plays in preparing a remnant of Israel for Yahweh's return with the Messiah built here in just 9 years, year 6000 Yah. This evening, we're going to talk a little bit about both the election in the United States and what it means, as well as what happened in Amsterdam. To begin with the election, there were some insights that were deeply troubling. It was an election between two horrible people, a narcissist that doesn't know how to keep his mouth shut, who pretends that he is pro-America when he is pro only one thing, himself. An exceedingly dangerous man because he will do anything for his own glory, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And yet he was the vastly superior choice because the woman running against him was less than a zero. She has nothing going for her, nothing to contribute, and nothing going for her. It is deeply troubling the few people who voted in a majority for her represent, well, let's start with Black Americans. You don't seem to be smart enough to recognize that the party you have loyally voted for is committed to keeping you poor, to keeping you disenfranchised, to keeping you as a racial minority that is dependent upon government. Because the only way they can depend on your voice, your vote, is for you to be dependent on the entitlements they have established. But in doing so, they have destroyed your past, your present, and their future. They have robbed you of your character and your sense of worth. The next is young people under the age of 29, and particularly women under the age of 29. You also voted for the numbskull. Same on you. You have no life experience. You haven't contributed anything in your life. You've been indoctrinated in an educational system, and you are largely progressive, which is today the most diabolical of religions, and it has a religious view. And it's sad that you can't see it. I watched, not the election results, that's not what I wanted to see. What I wanted to see is how institutions that called themselves independent and journalists and news reporters responded. And what I saw was that there was not even a pretense of being impartial, being a journalist, reporting on the events. They were in tears, Democrats as we, not as them. They made no attempt to report what was happening. They made every attempt to wallow in the pain and the shame of what they were experiencing. And their only retort was not to look at themselves and to say, you are the reason that the progressive candidates lost. The majority of Americans look at you and they are disgusted by you. And your only retort is to demean those who don't agree with you. You claim to hate hate, and yet you're the most hateful group on the planet. There is no correlation between what you profess and reality. The next group I want to talk about is American Jews. There is some dispute as to whether 69% or 71% of American Jews voted. Self-loathing Jew, yes, that's correct. Kamala Harris is Jewish. She's anything but black. She's Indian, not American, as in the continent of India, and Jewish. She's like Bernie Sanders, a self-loathing Jew. Whether it was by 69% or it was 80%, you voted for the woman that would have allowed Israel to disintegrate, who would have precluded weapon sales for Israel's defense, who would have stood aside and allowed the United Nations to pass resolutions against Israel. Now, that is so stupid. It's so irresponsible. It's so grotesquely immoral. And yet you're not smart enough to recognize your own shame. And what happened the next day ought to have proved it. If you had a brain, if you were capable of processing information rationally, American Jewish voters, you would have seen what happened in Amsterdam as absolute proof that what you did on election night was stupid. Mm-hmm. Before I talk about that, what I want to say quite clearly is that I would not have encouraged anyone to vote for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a narcissist. As a narcissist, he cannot be trusted to do anything other than serve his own interests.
Mm-hmm.
He has substantially impaired ethos and compassion for others. He will tear anyone to shreds, including those who are the closest to him. He will abandon anyone in a heartbeat. So I am not suggesting, American Jews, that you should be disgraced because you didn't vote for Donald Trump. I wouldn't have voted for him either. You should be disgraced because you voted for a progressive that would love to see Israel destroyed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to speak a little bit about Donald Trump, and then we'll go to what happened in Amsterdam and what it means. The pieces are now in place for us to know exactly what's going to happen. So I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Had Kamala won, she would have sent American troops into Ukraine to prove that she was G.I. Jane, that a woman can be tough. It's always the Democrats that get America into war. It's Republicans that get Americans out of war. It is the Democrats that want big spending, but the biggest spenders are always the Republicans. Why? Because the people's guard is down. They think that the peaceniks of the Democratic Party aren't going to commit them to war. That's the way they slander the Republicans. So so they take them into war. And they think that the Republicans are the tightwads and the Democrats are big spenders, so if there's a Republican administration, they're not worried about deficit spending. And so it's the Republicans that always spend the most. So the man who claims to be in favor of Israel, who moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, who identified the Golan Heights as Israeli, is going to be the man who imposes the two-state resolution.
Yeah.
And the reason he is going to do that is they're going to trust him. The reason he's going to do that is because he loves MBS. And he thinks that he has a superlative relationship with MBS and Saudi Arabia. And he thinks that should he be the man who establishes normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, that he will go down as the demagogue that he wants to be. And Israel's going to trust him. Netanyahu, in particular, who wants the same thing, is going to trust him. And so does Donald Trump, who is going to set Israel up for its demise by carving out a state of Islamic terrorism in the heart of Israel, and then dangle Israel out to be carved up by the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
That is what's going to happen. Now let's turn to Amsterdam. If you're listening to this program and you don't know what happened in Amsterdam, shame on you. If you're listening to this program and you don't care about Jewish laws, then you're really not covenant. Then you're not capable of thinking like a covenant member. Now, you can say, hey, wait a minute, you just slammed Jewish American voters. I did, because I care about Israel. And what happened in Amsterdam was a worse version of what happened on Kristallnacht. It was one day before the anniversary of Kristallnacht, when the Germans broke the glass windows of all the German shops. The Jewish shops in Germany. This time, it was Muslims, which is a cult very similar to Nazism. In fact, in Goddamn Religion, I devote several chapters to juxtaposing Hitler's Mein Kampf, the Quran, and Islamic Hadith. Same mindset. Same cult. What happened in Amsterdam is there was a soccer match and some Jews went to root for their team, and the mudslides that are there decided that they would first verbally attack them, and then as gangs of goons they would beat them up, kick them to the street, kick their heads in, knock out their teeth, bloody them up, hit them as gangs, and then run to the next. All while yelling, Free Palestine. Let me tell you something, mudslides, there is no Palestine. You are not Palestinians. There is nothing in Islam that has been or ever will be free. As a Muslim, you are a slave to Satan. Palestine was the place, the people of the Philistines. They were invaders. They were terrorists then. No trace of them exists today. That you call, that we call Israel, that you want to call Palestine, never existed. You're nothing but Muslims. And you're revolting. You are not qualified to live with civilized people. Immediately after 2001, I did something that no one else did. I went off and met with Al-Qaeda. I wanted to know why they flew planes into our buildings, why those suicide bombings occurred. And I did. I met with Al-Qaeda. I met with Hezbollah. I met with Islamic Jihad. I met with Hamas. So I asked them why. And they quoted vociferously from the Quran and from their hadith, quoting their wannabe prophet and wannabe God. So I did what everyone should have done, but no one did. There were, at the time, 6 billion people on the planet, and I was the only one that did this. I went and reordered the Quran chronologically and set it into the context of Muhammad's life using the hadith so that it could be understood. And then I wrote a book called Prophet of Doom based upon it. In the process, I did 5,000 radio interviews under my own name, doing something that no one has ever survived. And I was always asked, so what would you do? My answer was always the same. And it is the same today as it was 23 years ago. And since that time, we have seen Islam, the Islam again on 10/7. 10/7 attack was not made by Hamas or Islamic Jihad. And the war that's being fought now in Lebanon is not against Hezbollah, and the problem is not Iran. The problem is the same thing the Jews faced in Amsterdam. It's Islam. Not a corruption of the religion. Islam, as it is presented in the Quran and Hadith as it was lived by Muhammad. At the time, I said, there's only three things that you can do. And while I don't expect the world to do any one of the three, I'm telling you, if the world does not do all three of these things, then Muslims will make it impossible for everyone else to live. The death cult will become everything that Allah had envisioned for it, a plague on the human race. What were those three things? The first of them said politicians, academia, the media, anybody who has a voice needs to shed their ignorance. Now, I would encourage you to read Goddamn Religion. Then it was Prophet of Doom. That was one volume. Now it is five. 4,200 pages of analysis of the Islamic scriptures. Read it. Shed your ignorance. And then have the courage and the compassion to denounce the death cult that is Islam. It is demonic. It is demeaning. It degrades women. It degrades life to all forms of freedom. Even the hypocrisy of free Palestine. Not only is there no such place, every place that Islam exists and that Muslims are the majority, there's a complete deprivation of freedom.
Yes.
And there always will be.
Mm-hmm.
Muslims did on October 7th. Exactly what Muslims did under Muhammad's guidance. They were just more successful back then. They perpetrated genocide against Jews. Cut off the men's heads, raped the women, sold the children into slavery. That is what the Quran celebrates. That is what the Hadith celebrates. So the first thing you have to do is come to know your enemy. The enemy is not terrorism. That's a tactic. The enemy is not Hamas, not Hezbollah, not Islamic Jihad. It is Islam. And you need to be able to say it. To know it, to prove it, to say it with conviction. Evil must be exposed and condemned for there to be life worth living. Second, the world has to stop doing business with Muslims. It cannot sell them weapons. It cannot buy their oil. It cannot equip them to build mosques around the world. It cannot fund Islamic terrorism. Been doing it since the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Actually beginning at the end of World War I by gargantuan mistakes led by the British.
Yes.
Although the Americans were also complicit trying to carve up the world for its own economic benefit. Funding Islamic terrorism is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing. The third thing is, anytime there is a disease, a plague, a pandemic, as lethal as Islam, and it's the most lethal mind virus in the history of humanity, you must quarantine it. It must be isolated. You can't do what they did in Amsterdam and import the disease. You'll see what happens when they run rampant on your streets. You failed Jews in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. You failed them again last night. And how the world deals with the Jewish population says more about them than anything else. Islam must be quarantined. Let Muslims kill each other if that is what they wish to do, but in their own private domains. Isolate them. Do not allow them to infect others. They carry the disease with them, and they are deadly. Those are the three things that must be done. And if you don't do all three, you will die as a result. Now, back to the idiots, the 70 to 80% of American Jews that voted for the Democratic Party, for the squad,
mm-hmm.
for the self-loathing Jew, for the woman with absolutely nothing going for her other than she hates Israel. What would have happened in Amsterdam if there had been no Israel? Benjamin Netanyahu, with the new foreign minister that he had sworn in just hours before, sent him to Amsterdam with three El Al aircraft to evacuate those Jews. In the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, there was no Israel. There was no point of safety. There was no retreat, and the Holocaust happened. And I'm going to tell you that Europe today, with this infectious invasion of Muslims, is far worse than Europe was at the rise of the Nazi Party. But now, to the point of safety. As Netanyahu correctly said, that the difference between what happened then and what happened last night is that there is an Israel. American Jews that voted for the woman who had denied them. You should be ashamed of yourself, because without an Israel, you're right back into the Holocaust, and it will happen quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I wanted to share with you as we began this show. We're going to now return to the story, it's really a grand story, of the Red Heifer. We've just finished our review of Numbers 19. We understand the prophetic nature of the Adam HaPorah, who he is, when he will arrive, when this will transpire, for those that may have forgotten or didn't listen to the last program. The Red Heifer is a man. He will come into Israel with Elion on the 4th of April, 2030, the first of Abib. He's one of the two witnesses. He will have successfully overseen the Shavuot harvest of saved souls, which will take place on the 22nd of May in 2026. which is when Trump and Netanyahu will succeed in destroying Israel with the two-state resolution. We will be removed. You'll be on your own for the next 3.5 years. All you will have is the echoes of my voice and the images on the pages of the books we leave behind. There's 35 of them currently. You'll find them on the shelf, all royalty-free. Free in their entirety at yadayah.com and royalty-free from Amazon, and soon from our own independent bookstore, which is now created and will soon be presented. So, with Elyon myself, I will be known as Yada. I have a score of titles that Yahweh has ascribed to the mission that I am performing on behalf of Israel. They're all descriptive titles. There's none of them that are, you would say, are aggrandizing. The person who is aggrandized has earned it. His name is Dod. He is the Messiah. He's the returning king. I serve him. In those 3.5 years, Eliyah and I are going to be speaking from the Temple Mount, which will be cleansed of the Islamic scars, the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque, which are nothing but embarrassments to Islam anyway. A recreation of the Tent of the Restoring Witness and Eternal Testimony will be erected on that Temple Mount. And this is where we will stay and in front of which we will speak to the world. My last day, as part of this, will be Teruah. Religious Jews, you don't even know when that is. You think that your new year begins in your high holy days with Rosh Hashanah. It's a Babylonian holiday. You've replaced Teruah with Rosh Hashanah, which means you won't even know the date. It begins September 22nd, excuse me, 23rd of 2033, with the final gleaning of covenant members from Yisrael. And that night, it is my job to determine which Yehudim make the immortal trip to Shamayim and who is left behind, remain immortal. The next morning, as the sun rises, that is left behind, they will all have been left behind because they're filthy. They're still covered in their religious and political guilt, which Yahweh cannot tolerate, and which would cause them to be extinguished upon his return. God hates religion. He is apolitical. No one who is overtly religious or political will ever be seen in his presence. Ever. And so my job on the morning of Teruah, still a Shabbat, Saturday, September 24th of 2033, which is year 6000 Yah. If you think it's a different year and you're paying attention to what Muhammad said, then, well, you're ignorant. He was an idiot. There's no correlation between what he came up with and the Torah or truth. That morning as the sun rises, I will do a number of things. And we will speak of who I am in just a moment, because Yahshua has a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
But as the sun rises, I will let go of my immortality. Because I'm coming back from the Shavuot harvest as one of the two witnesses. The world will do everything they can to silence us, and yet we're impervious for 3.5 years. But on the morning of Teruah, I'm going to become mortal. I'm going to release the 7 ruach that have made everything I have done to this point possible. I'm going to release them. I'm going to dispatch the Malach who has served to protect me. And then I'm going to summon the corporeal manifestation of Satan, who will have been in Israel during the same 3.5 years. And I'm going to taunt him, just as Doe taunted Goliath, just as Eliah taunted King Ahab and Jezebel, as well as the prophets of Baal and of Asherah. And after taunting him, I said, "You wanted to silence me, to kill me, actually for thousands of years. Now is your chance. Prove to the world exactly who you are." And he will. Just as Rome bludgeoned the Passover lamb, Dode, our Messiah, our King, and then crucified him, my body will be ravaged. It will be a public spectacle. I'm going to be on the south end of the Temple Mount, overlooking the city of Dode, in the shadow of where Al-Aqsa Mosque once stood. And Eliyahu will be the master of ceremonies. Once this happens, he has very explicit instructions from Numbers 19 of exactly what he must do with my body, where he will place it. And something miraculous is going to happen. Yahweh is no longer going to stand by and be silent. It's only 10 days to his return, and he expects a favorable homecoming. In fact, he has already seen it. And so he engages. The first thing after Eliyahu has followed the instructions with the cedar planks, with the tohubah, the hyssop, and as he moved it to what was once the approach of the first temple, now a reincarnation of, not reincarnation, but a reestablishment of the tent of the witness, he will prepare it. And then Yahweh is going to unleash the torrent of water. It's reminiscent of the crag that Moshe struck. And it will gush forth with water. Just as there was copious amounts of water around the sacrifice of the bull during Eliyahu's direct rehearsal for this event, 2 millennia, 888 years exactly prior to this date. And then Yahweh himself will ignite the fire. Flames will tower to the heavens. The waters drenched in my ashes will flow off the Temple Mount into all of Jerusalem and will ultimately flow to the seas. The purpose is stated not only in Numbers 19, but also in Numbers 5 with the adulterous woman. As I said, the reason that the mortal remnant of Yisrael was left behind and did not to escape as immortals as part of the covenant family the evening before on Teruah is because they're still covered in religious and political filth. This is Yahweh's way of cleansing them of it. Their guilt will be purged, not only in the water, but incinerated in those flames. But they're prepared to go back 3,480 years to the time that they stood at the base of Mount Horeb and told Yahweh to go away. We never want to see you or hear from you again. He's turning back the clock to that moment. And it is the sacrifice of the red heifer that makes it possible. Now, I would not have known about this without reading Yeshayah. And quite frankly, I was blinded to it. God makes certain that we don't see things before we can process them. You know, that's why we don't talk to our children when they're 2 years old about adult things. Tell them what they need to know at the time that is useful for them to know it. Yeah, it was just the same thing for us. But I met him on Kahlua in 2001. He did not tell me that I was going to be sacrificed at the Red Heifer. I could not have processed it. I would have no idea. He did not tell me that I'd be responsible for the Shavua or Teruah harvest. He gave me a task, and I pursued that task. And then another, and then another. But that is what is going to occur. And the prophet Yeshayah explained it in a passage that I have translated and commented on 20 times. Yeshayah 17. And yet there it was. An explanation of the Shavua harvest of standing grain, followed by the Teruah gleaning of olives, with the explanation that the two or three on the uppermost branches and the four or five on the branches which had been cut away, which are protected in the crag, that their mortals left behind. That's the remnant of Yisrael. Those who will be there, according to Zechariah 12, witnessing the return of father and son of Yahweh and Dod. And what he said is that the Zeruah, which is the one cultivating those harvests, will become a Perah, a heifer. The man who has been employed this whole time as a par, as a bull, trampling out serpents wherever he finds them, whether they be religious or political or spiritual, is transformed into a Perah, a bloody red heifer. Now, with Yahweh, don't allow, although my friend Kirk sent me a picture that says, who are you calling a heifer?
I saw that.
It would be a confused bull, shall we say. it's pretty funny.
Thank you.
I don't have a sense of humor. I probably wouldn't appreciate it. But nonetheless, Yahweh calls three men a Zeruah, is a feminine term.
Yes.
The one cultivating the Shavuah and Teruah harvest, both of which are feminine, has a feminine title. This bull that has been part of the scene really since the start of the covenant. The first meal served as part of the covenant, he was there, along with the ram and the goat, which is Dod and Eliah. So he has to have feminine attributes at that time because he's giving birth, new life, to Israel, this remnant of Yisrael who were certain to die, the opportunity to live. And in a very real way, because of what happens to him following the Numbers 19 instruction, he represents the very tabernacle of Yahweh, which is presented entirely in a feminine way.
Yes.
And so that is the role that I've been asked to play. I will tell you that it strikes me very much, I'm sure, the way it influenced Dod long ago. Dod is my boss. He is the king of Yisrael. He's the man that I respect more than any other. Dod, like Moshe, wore out. Moshe wore out because the children of Yisrael were repulsive. I just don't know the term for it. You were repulsive during the Exodus. Disgusting. And finally, Moshe wore out. He did the thing that Yahweh asked him not to do, which actually Yahweh knew he was going to do it because he wanted to make a point. He struck the crack. Even Yahweh doesn't strike the crack. He talks to it. He talks to him. I am the crack. And what happens with that crack? It just works in water. what's going to happen to the rock underneath where the red heifer is. It will gush forth in living and cleansing waters. Yellow comes full circle in every story. Just as we are returning to Eden, that is what the seven Moed Mikre represent, is our return to the Garden of Great Joy. Everything that Yahweh tells us, he has told us before. It is a sign of a great playwright to reintroduce his themes. And that is what he has done. All right, now that you know who you are, who I am, let's begin again with Yeshayah 63:1. It is one of the most interesting, telling statements in all of the prophets. It is interesting because it speaks of a goy. A man from Edom can be none other than a goy. As a matter of fact, he would have to be from bloody red Rome, which is what my DNA says of me. He is not part of that. He opposes it. This is where he's coming from. Out of. Not who he is. And it says that this individual is going to save many. And it's so uniquely different than everything else that God says. The great prophet even says, I'm telling you the truth. It's like when Yahweh was speaking of his special relationship with Job in the 89th of Mizmor, he says, listen, folks, if all of these things I'm saying about my son, the Messiah, the King of Israel, don't materialize as I have said them, you can call me a liar.
Yeah.
It's the same thing we're witnessing here. Except Yeshayah would never say you can call me a liar, because you cannot call a prophet a liar. Everything a prophet says is true. In Hebrew, is this who comes, Bo, out of Edom, from those influenced by the bloody red nature of Rome, and thus the Western world, and perhaps the one who is exposed to the bloody red nature of Islam. And bloody red. Shemut. Crimson. Brilliant. Vibrant red. Deriving its color from those who are still yeasted and ruthless, cruel, and oppressive. And so these bloody red garments that will be worn by this man who comes out of Eden, says he is from a sheepfold in the sense of coming from a protected place. I will arrive in a very protected place. I am protected by Yahweh, not only here in my island home, but when I arrive in Jerusalem in 2030. And I will be wearing bloody red, because it is the symbol not only of where I have come out of and come from, but of the life I will be giving.
Yes.
The great prophet, a man who I feel is a brother, the man that wrote the textbook on proper chotering. If you don't know what a choter is, I would encourage you to read Yeshayah 11. You'll find it in the Observations series. It's presented elsewhere in addition to that. But the entire chapter is devoted to how Yahweh created the choter. It's a sucker from the original stump and fallen rootstock of Yisrael, and a secondary stem off the main branch, which would be a selfish stomach of doubt. He wrote, he is the one who has shown great favoritism and is respected and honored on high, treated with distinction. Therefore, he is suitably adorned and arrayed. Lebush, which is a variation of Lebanon, which means a lot of things, but doesn't speak of the country. striding purposefully, walking forthrightly with a sense of intensity and urgency in the abundance of his influence and authority. Koach, his power and might, potential and ability. The prophet says, I'm sharing this message with you, Anidabar. I'm communicating, verbalizing, announcing this matter using words accurately, Sadaka, correctly, verifiably, honestly, forthrightly, to liberate and save. La Yasha, to deliver, freeing many. Rob. Yashaya, Isaiah 63:1. You have three options with this statement from Yashaya. One is, you can accept it as true. And if you accept it as true, there's only one candidate in the world who meets the conditions that have been laid out here. You're listening to him. And you should continue to listen to him because he will save many. And because what Yahshua has revealed about him is accurate. Second, you can do what rabbis do with the majority of Yahshua and is to denounce it. To say it's not true, but if it's not true, then there is no God. There is no divine revelation. There is no hope. In less than 10 years, there will be no life on this planet. That's option number two. And if you are vocal about your renunciation of this prophecy, then, well, you are going to pay a very dear penalty upon Yahweh's return. Because it's not just the elimination of your soul. Your soul will become eternal, but eternally incarcerated in Sheol. The third option is to go along as most to do. Ignorant, unaware. Saying, I believe in the normalcy principle that tomorrow will be like today. But that was shot all to hell with COVID when the world changed dramatically, one day to the next. It was all changed dramatically on October 7th when you saw the world respond to Israel's self-defense. Saw it again in Amsterdam. Jews will be hunted down and killed everywhere in the world. It will never be like it was again. Those are your three choices. What you choose to do is up to you. Understand that with all that Yahweh has to say about this role that he would have me play, and he didn't force me into it, I volunteered. I'm an enthusiastic participant. And I recognize that just as was the case with Dode as the Passover lamb, it's nothing but a cruel and senseless murder without what Yahweh does with it. Which means that even those of us who are chosen by him to carry out roles like this, we are simply implements in the process. God doesn't see it that way. It's the truth. But once again, it's not how God sees it. God is really smart. And he learned a long, long, long time ago that there's no limit to how much one can achieve if he shares credit. He also is a father. And the thing that he wants most of all is to enjoy his family and his children. And when he has a child that does something that is exemplary, that he's proud of, he wants to acknowledge it, to credit that individual. That's why he says so many marvelous things about Moshe and about Dode. and about this man. It is in his nature to do so. Is he over the top, saying too much, just too kind and too generous? Absolutely. But it's his prerogative as a father.
Yeah.
And that's the role that he has chosen to play.
I happen to also,
it's also important for you to know that while Yala does ask something in return, I ask for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You go to yadaya.com. One of the things you'll notice is there's no donate button anywhere. It won't take your money. The books are entirely free. We ask for nothing. We don't ask even for your email address. We ask for nothing. You can stay and read all you want. Everything is there for free. We don't have a secret clubhouse someplace. We don't have a secret handshake. We're not offering laced lemonade or Kool-Aid. No. We're anti-religion. We're anti-political. We only have one human leader and one divine.
Mm-hmm.
King Goat and Yahweh. We serve them on behalf of his people. And therefore, I ask nothing, and I will take nothing. It's not true with Yahweh. If you want to live with him in his house, he expects five things from you. They are the five conditions of the covenant. You'll either abide by them or go elsewhere. And that's reasonable because eternity is a very long time to spend with people who are too stupid to not know who to vote for or not vote for. Or don't have the compassion and the courage to stand up against a death cult like Islam. God does not want to spend eternity with those kinds of people. So he has conditions, as he should. Last week I shared with you that Yahweh had made Yada and the red heifer unpalatable by design. My wife and I were talking this evening about, what is the best approach to reach Israelites, and I said, I don't know and I don't care. I'm not here to win your favor. I'm not here to garner your attention. I'm here to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I only have one approach to it, to be blunt. And I recognize that Yahweh isn't interested in speaking to anyone who is religious and political. So if you are religious and political, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want you to listen. I want you to go away. And if you are religious and political, I want to expose and condemn why that is a horrible choice and why God hates it.
Mm-hmm.
I will have nothing to do with you. And then I want to tell you exactly what God had to say. And the reason for that is that Yahweh has expectations. There is an upcoming harvest, less than 2 years away at Shavuah. My job is to make certain that the things that God will not tolerate are clearly known, religion and politics, conspiracy, for example. Wimps. They're unwilling to take a stand and do the right thing for his people. You know, the religious tyrants love the meek, not God.
Mm-hmm.
The man he loved most was a brave, valiant fighter who battled for his people. So did Moshe. And so, there is no desire to sugarcoat this. I want you to know Yahweh as I know him. I love him. He's my father. He is also my God, but he does not treat me as an inferior individual. We work together. And so I want you to know the God I know, because I love him and I appreciate him. I respect him. And I want you to know my King, because I love him too and I respect him. And so should you. He laid his down his life on Pesach. He carries his guilt into Sheol on Matzah so we could follow him home on Ukurim, firstborn children. So Yahweh made this voice, his call, Dod Bashar Herald, this man from Edom, he made him a bit unpalatable because, well, he's a goy. And that shouldn't be surprising. I just told you all great playwrights come full circle. All of the initial characters in God's story were goy. He's ending with what? This is because, of course, that the man from Edom is a descendant of Esau, who exposes the ugly soul of Judaism and progressive Israeli politics to save Yehudim from themselves. He is Hadar, shown great favor, and is respected, honored on high, and treated with distinction in heaven. While here on earth, the rabbis and the religious and the political lash out against him. I had somebody write me the other day. Says, you know, they're having a debate with a scholar, and they want to know how I came up with the O sound in Yahweh, and that Yahweh would be the destroyer. And what would you say to the scholar? I wouldn't say anything to them.
Go away.
And the religious scholars and the religious have been wrong for 3,000 years. Mm-hmm. In the prophets and in the Torah, God besmirches them. He exposes and condemns religion. He hates it. They have been wrong. They have hidden Yahweh's name. And you want to now go to them and say, how would you pronounce the name that you've hidden? And you would question a person who's written 35 books under the title Yada Yahweh, who in that very first volume explains to you exactly how you go about pronouncing all four of those letters?
Uh-huh.
No, I have no interest in talking to the religious scholar, nor should you. Ignore them. They've been wrong for 3,000 years, and their arrogance has blinded them even now. There is no hope for them. What rabbis have a claim for themselves is Hadar, when it will never be afforded to them. This exceptional Gentile has been given the very things that they crave. The chode or sucker, who has belittled religious dress-up, will be la labouche, suitably adorned and arrayed. By Yahweh, there is Ruach Kodesh, both as a witness and then as a sacrifice. There's a place in the 89th Mizmor, translated late this afternoon. It's another section of prophecy. Dode's song is God singing his love for his son and all the things they achieved together. This role that I play is prominent in that book, in that lyrics of that song, because without this role, Dode remains largely unknown. He is not respected for what he has achieved. No one knows that he is the returning Messiah and King. No one knows that he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bakura, and is therefore our Savior. And if you don't know these things, there is no salvation. And if you do not know these things, there is no one for Yahweh to come home to.
Mm-hmm.
It's all or not without this role. So Yahweh is speaking, and one of the things that he says, he's talking about this exuberant eruption of water that is going to come from the Temple Mountain. And he's saying that it's by my right side, and that his hand is in the sea. What that means is that he is above Moriah, and that he's looking over Dode's home on the city of Dode, the south part of the Temple Mount, is where he's looking down the ridge line of Zion. And his right hand is over the sacrifice that I have made for his people. God's very hand is going to excite the flames and cause the water to flow. And the picture right in the middle of this song sung to Job, because without this event, for me, listen, it is Job who is the right hand of God. It is Job who is going to exist forevermore at the right side of God. Job is the sun. The role I play is simply the moon reflecting the sun's light. But for this very moment, nothing is more important to God, because without what we are accomplishing together, his son can't reign as king, because there's no
right
people to come back to. And the owl explains the moment as he provides a spirit of reconciliation that floods over Jerusalem at this moment, as that remnant comes clean and witnesses he and his son return. Now it is, for a foreigner to garner Yahweh's respect, the time that it was so prevalent is when Solomon, Job's son, spoke of the Nasri, an observant foreigner, and the role that he would play in the last days. It's much of, however, the book of Yahshayah, which is prolific with the role that we are playing, because it is so essential. Not only reintroducing Job as the Messiah and King, who is returning, and as our Savior, as the Passover Lamb, and the one who fulfilled the Mikra of Matzah, the firstborn of Bukhudim, firstborn children. This role also has included reintroducing Yahweh's name to his people, reintroducing them to the terms and conditions as well as benefits of the covenant, reintroducing them to the purpose of the seven Moed Mikra, reintroducing them to the timeline so they know what happened when and what's going to happen going forward. Nonetheless, it is atypical for Yahweh to work through a foreigner. It's hard for many to even process, as I'm sure was the case initially for Yahshayah, who nevertheless devoted much of what was revealed to him to the children, to the Nakar, to this man from Edom. And so here, the prophet strove to be resolutely accurate by dispensing with all potentially equivocating commentary. He says, what I'm telling you is accurate, and many will be saved because of it. This witness would be suitably adorned and arrayed to complete God's mission, striding with a sense of urgency as time descends from man's hourglass. It's only 10 days left before Yahweh returns. With so few days remaining, and with the challenge being so great, this man will be operating with an abundance of God's power and authority. There is no time for a redo. There's no additional chance. And this means that his testimony is accurate, it's inspiring. It also means that the prophet is describing the Choder Stem, who is the lone individual said to have been enlightened, empowered, and emboldened by the seven Ruachs of Yahweh. Of course, I always chuckle at that because, you know, Job and Moshe needed one Ruach to get the job done, and Yahweh figured that I needed seven. There we go. But understand, it is a different mission and a different time.
Yeah.
He had lots of time with Moshe that played out over 40 years, taking them to the promised land, and 3,480 years after the Torah was revealed to this day. Lots of time. And with Job, he wrote all of his Mizmor 3,000 years ago, and he fulfilled Pesach, Mas, and Bukhudim 2,000 years ago. Lots of time. And in the case of Moshe, in the case of Job, Yahweh inspired them as prophets. He didn't have to teach them, although they did learn, particularly Job, but he inspired them as prophets. So he told them what to say. They said what he told them to say. That is not the case with the final witness. The final witness had to be educated. He had to learn on the job based upon what Yahweh had revealed to the prophets previously.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he was going to need lots of help seeing what everyone had missed.
Yeah.
And that is largely why that is. This is the case, as well as the fact is what I am saying is a death sentence against Islam. It's a death sentence,
mm-hmm.
would have been for most of man's history against Christianity. It would be politically a death sentence, and again, most of man's history. Just to be able to say these things, to figure them out and then say them, requires a lot of support. And from the day that I was called to the day that I will offer my life a teruah, to a teruah, 32 years apart, that isn't much time. And so there's a lot to learn and a lot to say. And the only way to make it all work so that Dode was restored to his proper place and Yahweh's name was reintroduced to his people was through seven ruach. And I'm telling you, I'm not letting go of any one of the seven just to prove that, you know, okay, God, I think I got this. Let's cut it down to seven. So I have a little more crack that comes through, a little more rock. No. No, I'm not doing that.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. At this point, Yahweh is so lavish with his credit. I'm happy to have been 1/1,000,000th of the result. And Yahweh having achieved all of the rest of it by empowering his Ruach. Now, affirming how distinct this is from everything else, Yahshua says something that, well, it only appears twice in all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, as I shared earlier. The first, after presenting a long list of promises and amazing statements regarding God, that he is not only the Messiah, but he was anointed deliberately by Yahweh, and that he is God's son, and that Yahweh is his father, and that he is the chosen one, that he is the Zeruah, the sacrificial lamb. After saying all of these things about his son, he says, you know, if everything that I've said here isn't true, you can call me a liar. Now, that was the first time. Second here, 300 years later, is when Yahshua says that he's telling us the truth, sharing this message accurately to liberate and save many. Therefore, we can surmise a number of things. First, this is so out of the norm, even for God, that the prophet is concerned that we won't take him seriously. Second, this revelation shades the way our generation will perceive Isaiah's viability and his credibility. All of the great effort that Isaiah put into communicating Yahweh's message is finally resonating with his people. Third, the messenger and the message Yahshua is acknowledging, even endorsing, will in fact save many. Now, it isn't saving many because this individual is great. It's because the God who is using him is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, in other words, this is important to Yah. We get the hint. It's important to Yahshua. It's been corrupted to Isaiah. It means Yahweh saves. His name is based on the same verb, Yasha, with Yah at the end of it, that he just said will be saved as a result of the man from Edom. And for the only way that this man from Edom can save many is for him to perform the role of the red heifer on Tarua. Therefore, since there is no other candidate for Yada, for the net, which is the sign that told that Yah was going to lift up the Choder, Nakar, or Zeroa, in our presence, much less the Adama Pura, which, by the way, these roles one ought not covet. I'm honored to have earned, by whatever I have offered, God's trust. But you need to know that to do this job, you're going to get up before the sun, and you're going to work at it until well after the sun sets, 7 days a week, for what will be 32 years by the time that this is over, without any remuneration other than God's appreciation. And then, at the end of it, you're going to be bludgeoned to death. So any attempt to disavow Yahweh's approach to his people is disrespectful to God, and it's disruptive to his purpose. Doing so will be measured in lost lives. I would much rather be anonymous, but not when it means lost lives. Well, Basra, which was translated sheepfold, was the city of Basra, a major metropolis under the Romans. It was also home to the Judea-menacing 3rd Legion, the Quraniyaka, which was took siege of Jerusalem in 70 CE, was deployed again to oppose the Bar Kokhba revolt in 133 CE. As Roman Catholicism grew, Basra became a religious center for the Byzantines. The Muslims captured the city shortly after Muhammad's death in 634 and turned its churches into mosques. Basra therefore serves as a microcosm of the bloody red nature of Imperial Rome and of the persecuting essence of Roman Catholicism and its grotesque anti-Semitism of religion and politics as mirrored by countries in Western Europe and the United States, and of course, eventually, of the dire effects cult known as Islam. It is from these things, distancing himself out of these things, that this man from Edom will emerge. The town is also on the road to Damascus, which is where the religion of Christianity was born. Before approaching the Word of God, I came out of all that Basra has come to represent. Now examining why the favored witness is adorned in red, Yeshaya explains the following. This is Yeshaya Isaiah 63:2. Can be known of your apparel being red. Edom, written identically to Adam, and of course, the red heifer is the Adama Pura. The color of wine is that your garments are similar to one who treads within the winepress, the Goth. Bloody red. The grapevine, of course, is symbolic of Yisrael. Wine is used as a metaphor to convey the value of the Passover lamb marking the doorway to life, as well as the new wine of inheritance. It is the wine also that is drenched on the wave offering during Purim, as saved souls are presented to Yahweh. The press is indicative of the fact that grapes, like olives and grain, are typically crushed before they become useful. Stress builds character in people. This is representative of the realization that Israelites will be hard-pressed before they return to God. Moreover, those nephists soul was crushed during Masa.
Yeah.
To redeem his people.
Oh, yeah.
There's obviously more to this because the continued focus on being blood red is the harbinger of the Adama Pura, the productive bloody red man on the ground, which is also what Adama means, serving as the red heifer. Pura means fruitful and productive. It is the feminine of Par, which is bull. Adam is the first man made in God's image with the Neshama. Ah makes it feminine, and it also means red and ground. These are Yahweh's names. It behooves us to understand what they mean. This is his time, and this is his story. By treading within the winepress that is Yisrael, he and his father will make an abundance of sweet wine, and it will be served during the Kippurim homecoming. To serve Yahweh, we must all do time in that winepress. Yeshayah, therefore, draws a comparison to himself, and in doing so, the prophet reveals why he is so excited over what he's witnessing. He has been toiling alone for a very long time and would continue to do so thereafter. There was no one to join him. Until now, 2,700 years thereafter. He said, I have tread the wine vat all alone by myself. Among the people, there was not a single individual with me. And so all of my apparel is defiled, and it is stained. Yeshayah, as a pure prophet, was the greatest of the prophets. I know Yahweh refers to Moshe, who was probably the greatest man who ever lived in terms of his character, as the greatest of the prophets because of his role in liberating the malcontents from slavery and taking them to the promised land. And Moshe deserves all the accolades in this regard. But as he's just a pure prophet, telling us the history of God's people, of why they were abandoned for their religiosity, and why they will eventually come back home. And the role that both Dod and the Choder, the Shemek and the Branch, will play in this regard. And so he is lamenting at this point that up to now he has been all alone. He's tread in that wine vat. He knows what it's like all by himself. He conveyed the most important message that we humans could ever possibly know.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there were no takers. Not a single person during Yeshayah's lifetime or for thousands of years thereafter capitalized on what he said. He is now our open textbook on how to do this job, bringing God's family back home.
Yeah.
This job would have been impossible without Yeshayah. We would not have known the first thing about Chodering. We would not have understood where we were going or how we were going to get there. So Yeshayah made it possible. And because what we are collectively doing together makes Yahweh's homecoming possible and the return of his son as Messiah and King possible, Yeshayah becomes the most important prophet of all time. His words matter.
Yeah.
Well, Yeshayah 63:3. For some ways it's painful to read. As a Jew, it should cause you to weep in shame.
Yeah.
When it comes to listening to Yahweh and responding appropriately, Jews have been few and far between. now bordering on zero.
Yeah.
And on this issue, announcing the role of the final Zeruah and what he would do in preparing the Israelites for Yahweh's return, Yahshuah is leading an exceedingly small band of brothers. But he is our teacher. Apart from the most recent 20 years, for the past 247 decades, there hasn't been a single Yehud, not one, willing to engage and serve as a prophet, much less even as a witness to the prophets. And as a result, everything associated with Yisrael has been defiled and desecrated, just as Isaiah described. It's been bloody as well. But now, at this time, there is someone who has emerged from the modern manifestation of Edom, who has finally stepped into the vat with Yahshuah. And we are treading as fast as our little feet will move. And he is conveying the same message found throughout the writings of the great prophet Isaiah. Yeah. This would include the realization that those who have sequestered the prophet's message and harmed his people must pay for their crimes, while Yisrael is redeemed from theirs. Now that's a tall order for the man out of Edom. Therefore, as a result, I was inclined to pursue my best judgment, a day of recompense, because the year of my redemption had come. Yahshuah 63:4. Now, this is an interesting insight because it means that Yahshuah's advocate realizes that the day of reconciliation, Yom Kippurim, is both a time of redemption and of recompense. And while clearly stated throughout the prophets, it is seldom acknowledged as part of Yahweh's return. This is the day that Yahweh arrives in Jerusalem. It is the day he comes back with his son, our Messiah, our Savior, our King, God. It also means that Yahshuah isn't just content to have a fellow co-worker.
Mm-hmm.
He wants all of those who have blocked his engagement held accountable. Mm-hmm. And the more I am exposed to the malfeasance of religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, progressive politics, the more I realize that the advocates of these things must all be held accountable because of the great harm they have done to this planet, to the people who live on it, and to God, as well as his son. It is odd to our ear to hear this mighty man of God speak of his redemption. Yahshuah was not only uniquely devoted to Yahweh, he was also a gifted linguist. He's the only prophet whose oratory rivals Moshe's and Job's. I will say without equivocation that as I strive to translate and understand the thoughts of the prophets, by far the easiest to understand is Moshe. It's all very plain, simple, right there, presented for us.
Yeah.
Very matter of fact. Job, very deep. Job's a profound thinker. Job came to understand because he makes the connections. And he helps us make the connections to transition from knowing to understanding.
Mm-hmm.
He is a great orator. A great thinker, a superb linguist. Yes. If it takes me X amount of time to translate a statement from Moshe, it's 2X for Job, and it's 4X for Yahshuah. It takes Yahshuah 17 that I spoke of, 17, 6, 7, 4, 5, 6, 7, really. And it's such that I've translated those passages probably 20 times. And it wasn't until this last time that it was the gut punch, where I realized why he chose these words, what these words really mean, what they lead us toward. And that's always the case with Yeshua. It's like we just looked at Basra, all that it means. Very simplistically, I'm coming from a protected place.
Yeah.
But look at all the additional insights that were conveyed as a result of that one word. So in spite of his lofty credentials and his superlative performance, his message and warning were squandered by those to whom they sent it. He had endured a lifetime without a single soul to show for his work, and so Yashaya, the great Yashaya, the linguist, he was exasperated. He was frustrated.
Sure.
And just as it is satisfying to know that we played a role in reintroducing Yahweh's name to his people and reacquainting Yisrael with his son, the Messiah, our King and Savior, God, there is a tremendous sense of satisfaction that comes from knowing that we made Yahshua's life and message resonate with his intended audience, so that rather than being alone, he is not alone anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He is greatly celebrated and appreciated. Success. The floodgates would be opened as the prophet saw his words poured out upon his people. There would be countless thousands returning to Yahweh, and so he felt redeemed. Even when he saw that the coder's life would conclude covered in blood, he even knew in that there was great victory. And that is why he made the connection between the Zeruah and the Perah, and the prophecy pursuant to Teruah. As a matter of fact, in the passage, the last one that I translated, I'm writing a commentary on now in my 20th attempt through the 89th Mizmor, the greatest piece of literature ever written. There is a statement that begins with Asher, which is the first word I translated. It has now blossomed into the 20,000 pages of Yada Yada. It was in what is among the most important prophecies ever written, 2 Samuel 7, about homes, who builds them, who lives in them. Yahweh speaking to his son, Dod, our king. The next word is the Am, the family and people of God, is followed by Yada, which is the name that Yahweh has ascribed to me and that I ascribe to the books that are written for him. And Yada Yahweh means to be familiar with, to acknowledge. In this case, to know and acknowledge Yahweh's name. And that is followed by Teruah. Asher. Yada. Teruah. It's not just the story of my life with Yahweh, which began on Teruah and will briefly end on Teruah. There will be a sacrifice on Teruah. My soul, of course, will survive this sacrifice and will celebrate it. But Teruah is the day that I was called to fulfill as Yada. And on behalf of the Am family of God, for Asher to share the benefits of the covenant relationship. And it's all there in Dod's song. And you read it and you say, well, thank you, Yah, for making this clear. I wonder why I missed it. the first 20 times through it. That is the way that we have, and we will continue to work together. The Parar prophecy that Yasayah shared that led us to these conclusions was also pursuant to Tarua, as is the case with the whole story of the Passover lamb. The prophet recognized that the red heifer's blood would accomplish something important. And it, of course, is the bull's blood that is anointed, not only on the Ark of the Covenant, but on the approach to the tabernacle. It will be, the Ark of the Covenant will be restored, and the tabernacle will be restored, as I shared with you. And it is the bull's blood that makes it possible for Yisrael to approach. It will be those that will be sprinkling it. It will be, yes, it will be Eliyah that will have supplied it, will have come from my bludgeoned body. And of course, then Eliyah will add some of his own. It's the goat that, and the bull that anoints the mercy seat to the Ark of the Covenant, so that Yisrael can be reconciled unto Yahweh and be prepared for his arrival. So reflecting on the frustrations which had preceded this particular vision, this will be the last passage I'll share with you this evening, and we'll commence again next week. He wrote, "Having continuously looked, and having found no one to help, I was devastated, and I felt abandoned. I was deeply affected and hurt, feeling inadequate, actually stunned, even astonished and appalled that I had been deserted." So imagine being Yasayah. Mm-hmm. This is a great man. This is a man with a soaring intellect, great devotion and passion for Yahweh. The man who told the entire story of Yisrael, from religious reprobates to those who were celebrating their gods and kings' return, and how all of this would transpire. God entrusted him with delivering the most relevant and inspiring prophecies in human history. And yet no one listened. A lifetime of devotion seemed to be for naught. The message had been so clear, so compelling, and the benefits of what Yahweh was offering so marvelous. The apparent failure tugged at his soul. He felt abandoned by his people.
Mm-hmm.
And for good reason. They did betray him. Therefore, Yahweh, who is spectacular at supporting his children, his co-workers, those who are devoted to what matters, he allayed the concerns of humankind's most recognized prophet. He took Yasayah, Isaiah, forward in time so that he could enjoy what would become of his message. God showed him how a non-Israelite would come to cherish his words and share them, serving his God. He would breathe new life into every nuance of every word Yasayah conveyed to us. Yasayah's prophecies would resonate within the hearts of the children of Yisrael. They would call them home. It would just take a while. There would be, as Yasayah has foretold, a final Zeruah, the third of three, someone to follow after Moshe and Dod, just a different role, who would shine under the spotlight Yasayah had brilliantly provided. Long spurned, this prophet was so excited by what he had been shown, he may have written my Zeruah to indicate that this witness was sowing his seeds, disseminating Yasayah's own inspiring words, And if he did,
aww,
God bless him for it. Yeah,
it's
it is
so sweet.
It is sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But regardless, when we juxtapose what Isaiah revealed about the Zeruah and the Parah in concert with Teruah earlier in the 17th chapter, and how the bloodied man from Edom will reconcile and restore Yisrael in connection with this same Zeruah, the conclusions are evident. And so I did not speak totally forthright with you moments ago. I will read one more statement from Yahshua, and then we will bid you good night. So when there was no one to provide any support, my Zeruah, the strengthened arm, sowing my seeds to cultivate the harvest, he will deliver victory for me by bringing salvation through me, even though my disappointments and emotional turmoil remain. Isaiah 63, 5. And
yes,
now I really
yes.
can't read anymore, because that has caused my eyes to well up with tears. So tears of joy for this man. And so that's
yes.
all I can read, because, well, as I've shared with you, it's emotional. I care deeply for this man.
Mm-hmm.
I admire what he has achieved, and I'm thrilled that he has been vindicated. He has provided the textbook for proper children. We have paid attention. But he also provided a textbook for the world, and particularly for Israel. Pay attention to the Choder
mm-hmm.
and to listen to what he has to say. Because he is, at this moment in time, the cold voice of God. He is, at this time, the Zeruah, the one cultivating the upcoming harvest, both of Shavuah and Teruah. And he is the Anima Parah, who will lay down his life to restore those of Yisrael. We bid you good night. Thank you for listening. We look forward to being with you next week. And may Yahweh bless you all. Have a wonderful, fulfilling, and enjoyable Shabbat. Good night to all.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, Kirk. Good night.
Good night, guys. Good night.
Good night.
I'm normally the person who sucks at that, plans a date, so it was nice to
let someone else do the work for us?
Weirdly, yeah.
I mean, the rage was the rough.
I just wasn't ready to go home, you know?
I wasn't either. By day 6, we've done every activity uptown.
So crazy, but so fun.
Who taught you to think the way you think? Your business or personal growth isn't limited by the market, economy, or competition. It's limited by your mindset. Like the world's top performers, you need a think coach like Keith Kraft, who can remove those limits. Think coach Keith Kraft has shared the stage with presidents and world leaders, built generational wealth, and coached others to do the same. Join the online think tank, a transformative coaching experience designed to unlock your full potential. Sign up today at keithkraft.com and start your journey to greatness.